Our meeting on March 24th, 1987, at 3 p.m. in Hearing Room A. We will have public hearing and testimony on Senate Bills 20 and 21.
Senate Committee on Judiciary will come to order. It's 3:09 p.m. I have a few preliminary remarks before we start the testimony in this matter. First, I want to tell you that there is overflow seating available in room 50 in the basement and in room 343 in the old part of the building. That's on the third floor. Both of those rooms will have audio and television, or not? Audio and television. And we would prefer that individuals who do not find seats in this room go to either room 50 in the basement or room 343 upstairs. I think you'll be more comfortable, for one thing. You won't have to stand up for such a long time. The other thing that is going to happen during the course of the hearings on Senate Bills 20 and 21, when it comes to the public testimony, and since I don't know the names, but have all the names written down of those who hope to testify, and because of the size of the crowd, I'm going to call, each time I call the name of a witness, I'm going to call the next one or two witnesses at the same time, so they'll be ready to come up here, and we're going to be able to get by with as little waste of time as possible. That would be especially true of individuals who want to testify who are in the other rooms. It will give them a chance to get here. The next thing I want to say is that if you want to exercise your First Amendment rights in front of a legislative committee, you're welcome to do so. I want to tell you that all of us on this committee are very strong supporters of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, which gives everybody a right to speak freely, and we're also supporters of the constitutional right to petition your legislature. But if you want to turn off members of the Oregon legislature, no matter what their views are, you will distribute the kind of scurrilous material that I've seen already distributed in this meeting. We do not appreciate that. We'd like to hear from all of you with all points of view, but it's no way to get any place with your point of view before the legislature to hand out the kind of material I've seen handed out already today. That's just a word of advice for you. I hope that we can accommodate everyone who wishes to testify. That may or may not be possible because, you know, the Senate Judiciary Committee is the busiest committee in the Senate. We have about 300 bills that we have to deal with during the session, and if we spent several hours on each of those bills, you can see right away we never would be able to adjourn the legislature, and the taxpayers would have to keep us here all winter long to get our work done. So it might be that we're not going to be able to take everybody, although we're going to try. One way that we might be able to take everybody is if you will kindly follow the guidelines that have been distributed to you. That is, keep your testimony brief. Try to state a point of view that someone else has not already stated. We're hoping to keep the testimony down to 2 or 3 minutes per person. I would point out to you that my schedule today calls for first an overview of the work of the interim task force. So I'll be calling on the Senate chairs of the task force committee to kind of give us an overview of what that task force did, and a couple of other individuals that were on the task force. And then we have invited testimony from a number of individuals, pro and con, that we think would help the committee understand the bills and also what might be done to improve those bills. And that will conclude about 5 o'clock. Now, this committee normally adjourns at 5 o'clock. We're going to try and accommodate the great interest involved here, and so we'll be here after 5 o'clock, needless to say. Public testimony probably won't start till after 5 o'clock, and so you're going to have to be patient while we go through the invited witnesses here. In terms of witnesses, public witnesses after 5 o'clock, if you've signed up on the witness sheets, There will be some priority given to you in terms of when you're called. If you're in other words, those folks who aren't signed up are going to be, if we have a chance to get to you at all today, it's going to be at the end of the agenda. And I believe, counsel, is correct that these guidelines for testifying have been put out in the front hall there, so all the people who are going to testify should have been able to pick one of these up.
Okay.
All right. Now, I'd like to ask Senator Jane Cease and Senator Nancy Riles, who are the co-chairs of the Interim Task Force on Death with Dignity, to come forward with any other witnesses that they want to bring.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am State Senator Nancy Riles, and I am here today to present to you Senate Bills 20 and 21. This is legislation that was drafted by the Senate Task Force on Death with Dignity, and they are here before you today.
Senator.
Yes.
Let me just interrupt. You and I have had a conversation before about how we would handle questions that might come up in this phase, and I want to ask the committee members if you would do the following. Can we tomorrow night we have another group of invited witnesses who are going to kind of pinpoint, make suggestions for changes in these bills, and I would ask the committee members, in view of the time, unless it's terribly urgent, if you could hold your questions until tomorrow night's witnesses, and that way we can get through the invited witnesses tonight, hopefully by 5 o'clock. Go ahead, Senator.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do think that will be helpful in getting to everyone and the people that are wanting here to express their opinions to you. As many of you know, the task force met during the interim to do two things. We were to study issues related to the rights of the terminally ill and to evaluate the impact and the effectiveness of Oregon's current death with dignity statutes. And sitting before you today are members of that interim task force. Sitting next to me, of course, is Senator Jane Cease, who co-chaired the task force with me. And sitting next to me is Bob Shoemaker, who is an important person in this work. He worked very extensively with the Judiciary Committees in 1983 on revising some of our living will statutes at that time. He is an attorney with Miller Nash in Portland and a former president of the Portland City Club. Sitting next to him is Dr. Roy Payne. He was a very important member of the task force as well. He is a clinical associate professor of medicine and geriatrics at the Oregon Health Science University. He has his own practice in internal medicine and geriatrics, and he is a former president of the Oregon Medical Association. I'd also like to introduce to the committee at this time, and again, because of tight time restraints, they will not be able to speak individually themselves, but sitting behind me here is Alita Chase, a nurse herself and an associate administrator of Best Kaiser Hospitals, who served on the committee and was very important in keeping us at task. Sitting next to her is Joyce Colling, who is a registered nurse and a PhD doctor herself. She is the project director of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Teaching and Nursing Home Project, which she applied for that grant and is responsible for that grant and is recognized for her authority and responsibility and expertise in the matter of nursing homes. And she is an assistant professor and a community health care systems person at Oregon Health Sciences University. Then sitting next to Alita and next to Joyce is Dr. Marshall Wattles. He is a PhD, he is a professor emeritus from the University of Oregon in economics, and he was another important member of our task force that insisted that we get the job done. So I hope all of you will join me in recognizing all of the members of the task force contribution, the many hours of time and dedication that went into the task force's work. Just briefly, the task force held 5 meetings around the state. We held meetings in Salem, Pendleton, Medford, and Portland, and we took testimony from more than 100 Oregonians. We had over 300 people participate in those hearings from all walks of life. And I think I can say unequivocally that we came away from those hearings thoroughly convinced as a task force that, number one, Oregonians want a voice in what medical procedures are used, and sometimes more importantly, what medical procedures are not used when they are in the active and natural process of dying. Secondly, they want to have control over the final moments of their lives. They want to be able to give instructions ahead of time so their families and their loved ones who care for them will clearly understand their wishes, even if they themselves are not able to communicate. Fourthly, they want to have those wishes respected, and they want to have those decisions carried out, but they do not want to put in jeopardy any person who is charged with the responsibility of carrying out those instructions. We also discovered that people want a clear, delineated process for dealing with those situations when individuals have not made their wishes known and they are no longer able to participate in their health care decisions. And sixth and finally, we heard overwhelming testimony that they want safeguards to protect those options, and they want safeguards to be sure that those options will not be misused or abused. And to summarize, Mr. Chairman, I would just say from the hours of testimony taken on this task force, Oregonians want to be able to make their own decisions, and they want to make their own choices about the final moments of their lives, and they do not want anyone else's beliefs or anyone else's choices imposed upon them. The task force found there is confusion, and a great deal of confusion, surrounding the interpretation of our current laws, and particularly the effects of a variety of recent court decisions that has added to the confusion both from the provider standpoint and from the patient standpoint. And attached to my testimony is Appendix A, which kind of gives a historical perspective on living will statutes, the 38 states that have them, and some of the chronological development in the last few years affecting the need for this type of legislation. The task force also came to the clear conclusion that our laws need to be clarified. And in doing that, as you can see by what is going on in this room, it is a very difficult and a most sensitive type of task. But we also felt to ignore or walk away from the challenge would really be to abdicate on our responsibilities to the citizens of this state because of the confusion and the choices that exist out there and the lack of people's understanding and their abilities to deal with the new things that are coming about in the medical technology professions. And so it is for all these reasons that the task force presents to you today two bills that deal with modifying our current living will statutes that have been on the books since 1977, and Senate Bill 21, which introduces a power of attorney for health care, which is really a new concept that was introduced in California and passed in California just last year. Briefly describing Senate Bills 20 and 21, you would know that, as I mentioned to you, under the statutes that were passed in 1977, we currently have living will statutes, which is called a directive to a physician. It allows no personal options, no individual choices. One fills out that document exactly as it is with no deviations. And we expanded on that. If you'll see of page 2 on Senate Bill 20, we have proposed language there that says that recognizing the individual differences that exist on this issue and respecting the individual's right to make those decisions, there are really three suggested forms proposed. The first one deals with really the burden-benefit type of argument, in which if a person is in the active and natural process of dying, if the continuation of life-sustaining procedures tends to merely prolong death, not prolong life, but prolong death, and the burden of those treatments outweigh any benefits, that a person can say, it is my right to say, I do not have to continue with these procedures. The second one addresses the issue of the comatose patient, who technically is not in an active and natural process of dying, but is in a permanent vegetative state. And it says that after 60 days and two doctors authorize and put in the medical record that that is the condition, that certain life-sustaining procedures can then be removed after consultation with a list of people that give their permission to do that. There are, of course, many other things. It also expands on allowing not only more choices in the wording of directives, but also addresses the issue of oral directives as well, and it also limits some of the witness requirements. And other speakers today will go into those details for you. I think it is fair to lay before this committee, as the task force has been very open in all its deliberations, that the most controversial issue proposed in Senate Bill 20 is amending the definition of life-sustaining procedures to include artificial and mechanical means of nutrition and hydration. I think it is very important to emphasize the words artificial and mechanical means of nutrition and hydration. And attached to my testimony is Appendix B that goes into detail about what we mean when we say artificial and mechanical means of nutrition. Unfortunately, there is much misinformation about this bill. Some people think it refers to the patient comfort of food and water. The language specifically says, but not including care necessary to sustain and promote patient comfort. And artificial and mechanical means of nutrition are outlined there for you. Others will speak to it. It mainly refers to a nasal gastric tube, which is inserted through the nose, down the back of the throat, into the stomach, a stomach tube, which is inserted into the abdominal wall for feeding, and some other procedures that have to do with putting needles in your neck. And the doctors here will talk about that in much more professional detail than I can. But that's what we're talking about. Artificial and mechanical means of nutrition and hydration. That is a controversial part of the bill. Moving then on to Senate Bill 21 is something that in the testimony before the task force, I'm really kind of surprised about some of the letters I have been receiving when they talk about opposition to Senate Bill 20. We really heard very little opposition to Senate Bill 21. What Senate Bill 21 does, it just establishes a durable power of attorney for health reasons. And it simply acknowledges what we heard through testimony is the existing laws that talk about when you can't make your own health decisions, you refer to your next of kin, that we are a very mobile society now, and families do not all stay living in the same state. And many times, next of kin is no longer appropriate. Someone may be living in Oregon, their next of kin, a relative or so on that's closest to them, maybe an aunt in Nebraska who they haven't talked to for 20 years, and they have a very close friend or a member of their church, or someone else that is close to them now, and they would like to be able to appoint them to have the power of attorney to make health decisions for them. And that is what was introduced at the request of many people, particularly people in our elderly population who no longer now or sometimes are the very last of their family members, and there are others that they feel can make those decisions for them. Finally, although the task force has recommended many changes, I would like to point out for the committee's benefit, we were unanimous in upholding the intent of earlier death with dignity statutes that, again, have been on our books for 10 years by stating quite clearly in both Senate Bill 20 and in Senate Bill 21, Senate Bill 20, it's in Section 10, and throughout the task force's meeting, we had these words on a very large cardboard set up in front of the task force meeting, and I quote from the bills themselves, "Nothing in these acts is intended to condone, authorize, or approve mercy killing, or to permit any affirmative or deliberate act or omission to end life other than to allow the natural process of dying." Mr. Chairman, members of the Judiciary Committee, the Death with Dignity Task Force has tried to draft legislation that gives options to individuals, that lays out clear, delineated procedures for exercising those options. And at the same time, we have tried to draft legislation that includes appropriate checks and balances, but yet at the same time walks that line between unnecessarily limiting individuals' rights to control the final moments of life. And as you debate these very serious issues, and as I know the timing is very difficult for this committee, you have just come off an exhausting amount of work on tort reform, a very long meeting last night, I would just ask you to recall the findings of the task force in four things. Oregonians do want a voice in what medical procedures are used or not used when they are in the active and natural process of dying. They want to retain control over their own lives. They do not seek to impose their choices on anyone else. and they do not want anyone else's belief or standards imposed upon them. It is in that spirit that we, all seven of us here today, present to you Senate Bills 20 and 21, the result of the task force's work.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Cease.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. As Senator Riles has said, these bills are the result of a tremendous amount of participation by a lot of people from every part of the state. They represent a lot of solid, hard work, and my sense of the public is that I think at least two-thirds of the people of Oregon support what these bills do. You will hear a lot of opposition, and I want to just sort of lay some of that out for you. As Nancy said, you'll hear that this will bring about euthanasia, although Section 10 clearly says not. You will hear that a major church opposes them when, in fact, all Oregon hospitals, including the church-operated ones, desperately need this bill and, in fact, are trying, actually, some of them, to meet its objectives with their own protocols. But those won't solve the problem for them or for the patients. You will hear a lot of people who don't want to listen to the facts about the bills. You will hear from people who want their own personal religious beliefs made into law for all of us. But I hope that you won't, through all of that, be distracted from the main point, and that is that our current law is inadequate to address the wishes of people to direct how, when they are in the active and natural process of dying, they wish to die and to die with dignity. The bills raise questions of honor and respect. Will the state of Oregon respect the directives of a dying person and require that the closest family or friends of a dying person and the health care providers honor the person's wishes about dying with dignity? And believe me, I know how difficult this process will be for you. I've been through it in all of the hearings and the work sessions of our task force, and you have my support, and I will be happy to help you in every way that I possibly can.
Thank you, Senator. Next.
I'm Bob Shoemaker. As Nancy, Senator Riles, said, I'm a member of the task force. The one mistake she did made was to attribute me to the wrong law firm.
Yes, it is Lindsay Hart. I know as soon as I said
I'm with a firm of Lindsay Hart, Neal & Weigler in Portland.
We might have had another announcement here today, Bob.
My role today is to summarize why it is important to have a change in the law and what the bill does to meet those. To meet that importance. Some of what I say will repeat some of what Nancy said, and I will try not to dwell on those points. As we all know, the advancing medical technology has the effect of taking the patient out of the action or when the end of life is coming. And people can be kept alive for months, sometimes years, when they are no longer able to control their destiny. What we're trying to do in this bill is to put the patient in charge and to give the patient as much flexibility as possible to control in advance of when he is no longer in charge, to control what will be done when that time comes, and to try to strip away a lot of the technicalities and encumbrances that the present law, as good as it is, imposes upon him. We also try to anticipate what certain patients would want if they did not plan in advance for this need by providing what we think are reasonable rules to allow life to end in appropriate circumstances. Present law, as Senator Riles said, prescribes a mandatory form, a single form of directive. A directive shall be in the following form, is what the statute says. It's a pretty good form, but it doesn't leave any room for individual choice. And a lot of people, some of my own clients, have wondered about, what if I want to do this and what if I want to do that? what if I'm in a coma and my death is not imminent? Can I direct that life support be withdrawn, or can I not? That's one important example of what the present form leaves out. What about the patient who, while technically not terminal, has a heart which stops and goes and just simply doesn't want to have to live under those conditions anymore and would like to be able to die when the heart stops, doesn't want to be brought back? Does the form cover that? It's not clear. The present form also is one crafted by lawyers to protect against abuse. So its witnessing requirements are cumbersome. The witnesses cannot be relatives, cannot be heirs, and cannot be people associated with any medical facility where the patient is confined. So in order to execute this form, you have to do a fair amount of planning. You have to do it before you're in the hospital, unless you make arrangements to bring people in who are neither family nor heirs to witness it. Most people don't really plan their lives that carefully, however much we'd like to think that they do so. You deal with these kinds of issues when you're confronted with the need, and that most often occurs when you're in the hospital. The result is that the present form, although in some use, is not used to the extent it should be after having been on our books for about 10 years. There's no room in the present form to do things somewhat informally. Physicians normally prescribe for their clients, recommend treatment in a consultation mode, not in formal written documents. Thus, this bill, Senate Bill 20, would allow a directive to be not only written — those are fine and we applaud them — but oral. Any way that you can effectively communicate your wishes to your doctor, providing that you have one additional witness so that there is a check there, will do the job. We also would require that it be put in the medical record so that the doctor can stand up and be counted. When a directive is made, he is responsible to put it in the medical record so it can be looked at, drawn upon by others, and so there's something standing behind a decision to make a directive. The present law does not make following a directive mandatory. It's discretionary. So there are no sanctions for not following a directive. So you have the situation of a patient person making a directive saying, I don't want to be kept alive in these circumstances. The circumstances occur, the patient is no longer competent, the family, from feelings of guilt or whatever, don't agree. They think they ought to keep the patient alive, and so you have conflict between the family and the patient, who's no longer plugged in. The doctor doesn't quite know what to do. Without a consensus, he's apt to just allow the situation to continue to keep the patient on life support, even though that's what the patient said he didn't want, because it's safer than getting into a rhubarb with the family. Senate Bill 20 would require the doctor to follow the directive. And if he's not willing to do that, then he must resign from the case. We don't say he has to do that which his whole being says he can't do. That's going too far. But if he's not willing to do what the patient has said he wants done, the doctor should resign, and the law, Senate Bill 20, would require that he resign. Similarly, the healthcare facility, hospital, if not willing to follow the doctor's instructions or the patient's instructions, will assist in transferring the patient to another facility. Now, we don't require that the new doctor or the new facility be one that will follow the directive. We just require that there be a transfer to a new doctor or to a new hospital. Let them deal with the situation. A very important change, and one which Senator Riles talked about, is clearly including within the definition of life-sustaining procedures artificial and mechanical provision for nutrition and hydration, except care necessary to sustain and promote the patient's comfort. In other words, when food and water administered through feeding tubes are necessary because of hunger pangs and thirst, they will be provided. The law would not permit tubes to be withdrawn in those circumstances. But when the patient has gone beyond that and his body doesn't want food and water anymore, or if he's in a coma and cannot have any sense of food and water being provided, in those circumstances, artificial, that is, feeding tube,
should retain the authority to designate the attending physician. In view of the power of the attending physician to terminate life-sustaining procedures, the designation of the attending physician is a critical one and should not be removed from the patient or the family. Number four, under sections 5 and 13 of SB 20, the penalties for a physician and healthcare facility, if they fail to follow a directive or to take reasonable steps to transfer care to another physician or healthcare facility, are too severe. Charges of unprofessional conduct for the physician, or suspension or revocation of license for the healthcare facility, when either or both find themselves ethically in objection to a proposed course of withholding or withdrawing life-sustaining procedures, may have a chilling effect on the pursuit of ethical treatment by both the physician or the healthcare facility. Number five, under Section 6 and 7 of SB 20, there is no informed consent of the person to withhold or withdraw life-sustaining procedures. To the extent that both sections permit a withdrawal or withholding of life-sustaining procedures and the resulting death of the patient occurs, the sections raise the constitutional issue of the taking or deprivation of life without due process of law. Number six, Section 7 chooses the arbitrary standard of being comatose for at least 60 days. In the Church's Statement on Uniform Rights of the Terminally Ill Act, we find negative judgments about the quality of life of unconscious or otherwise disabled patients have led some in our society to propose withholding nourishment precisely in order to end these patients' lives. Society must take special care to protect against such discrimination. Number seven, the standard of care in Section 9 of SB 20 for a physician, licensed health professional, or healthcare facility should not be lowered from our existing state law to a standard of who in good faith acts in substantial compliance with this act. Section 9 is tantamount to blanket immunity from civil or criminal liability for the professional and institutions involved. The conference seeks a public policy which clarifies the rights and responsibilities of health professionals without giving blanket immunity from all legal liability. No physician should be protected from liability for acting negligently, nor should new legal penalties be imposed on a physician for failing to obey a patient's or proxy's wishes when such obedience would violate the physician's ethical convictions or professional standards. Existing law addresses this issue, providing for a standard in ORS 97.083 sub 4 for acting in good faith and in accordance with the requirements of this section and ORS 97.084. Number 8, the wording of SB 10 of Senate Bill 20 is not faithful to the intent of not entering into the practice of euthanasia or mercy killing.
Is it us or this bill you're trying to talk to, Dad?
I intend no offense, Senator Wires.
It's awful hard to listen to a lawyer read something that's over 10 pages long. You've been around here long enough to know that. And there's 100 people sitting out here, and we were up at 10 o'clock last night. I happen to agree with a lot of what you're saying, but You're hurting your own position by
doing it. I'm almost done, Senator.
Well, you've got three more pages. Go ahead.
I'll try to be quick. The wording of Section 10 of SB 20 is not faithful to the intent of not entering into the practice of euthanasia or mercy killing. Despite requests to the interim task force to define euthanasia or mercy killing in the bill, the legislation is silent as to what the terms mean. Section 10 itself is an example of circular reasoning with the phrase, as permitted in this act, nullifying the preceding undefined terms. The same objection is true in the wording of Section 15 of Senate Bill 21. Number 9, in Senate Bill 21, once an attorney in fact has accepted nomination to that position and the principal becomes incapacitated, there is no provision for the attorney in fact to resign if he or she cannot carry out the responsibilities assigned under the power of attorney for health care. This is bad public policy because it forces an individual to make decisions which the individual no longer wants to make. In view of the above, and as the conference analyzes these bills, after participating for 6 months in the work of the task force, our request is that the Senate Judiciary Committee, and we offer this to you in a most respectful fashion, table both bills. I'd be glad to respond to any questions.
Thank you. All right, we'll move to other invited testimony. And first witness will be Maureen Lohr. Maureen Lohr. Now, I want to repeat what I said at the beginning. It's the committee's hope that everybody who wants to say something is going to be given a chance here in the next day or two, but I hope you folks understand the time constraints that we're all under here and that you'll try to abide by the directive that you limit your testimony, try to express a point of view that maybe is your own, that's different from others, and kind of pay attention to the clock here. So we'll go through a number of invited witnesses now, ladies and gentlemen. And these witnesses are not supposed to exceed 10 minutes each, so we'll kind of let the audience out there in on that secret. Go ahead, Mrs. Lohr.
My name is Maureen Lohr, and I live in Portland. On June 16th, 1977, a tragedy happened to my family. And that tragedy has continued on every day for almost 10 years. My little boy, Jason, who was 6 years old then, was in a drowning accident. He is now 16. His heart had actually stopped for over 5 minutes. They airbagged him to the hospital, and after 5 defibrillations, his heart came back to life. The emergency room doctor came into the room where I was waiting and told me that they had started his heart. I said, thank God he's alive. The doctor looked very grim as he told me that that's not the end. He has a long way to go. I looked at him and thought, what does he mean by that? Jason is alive. He will stay in the hospital until he recovers his strength, and then he will come home. At that time, I didn't know that there is life, death, and an in-between, but I know now. Jason has been in a vegetative condition for almost 10 years. The difference between a coma and a vegetative condition is that you can come out of a coma, but a vegetative condition is forever. Jason has a tracheostomy so that he can be suctioned easily, and a gastrostomy, which is a feeding tube that is surgically implanted into his stomach. He is 16 years old and is about 5 feet tall and weighs about 40 pounds. His body is twisted and drawn up. His hip has been dislocated for 7 years. We have watched him suffer a lot over the years, as pain is the only feeling he has left. He has no voluntary movements of his limbs. The only movements you see in him are the seizures he has all the time. I don't think anyone realizes that to starve someone to death in Jason's condition would not be painful. Jason vomited 3 or 4 times a day when I had him at home the first year after his accident, causing life and death situations every day and night because his body was rejecting the food that was being put right into his stomach. I think the body was saying, leave me alone. Jason's quality of life is nil. His only life is the care we give him. His whole life consists of being turned over in his bed every hour to avoid bed sores. That is his whole life. He was an intelligent little boy when this accident happened. And he would not want this for himself. Who in this room would? This could happen to each and every one of us. And the way the law stands now, there is nothing we can do about it. Technology has surpassed the laws, and we need to catch up. The highest court in Massachusetts ruled last year that a 49-year-old fireman left in similar condition to Jason for 3 years following an accident should have the feeding tube removed. Families should not have to go through these grueling court cases. There is enough to bear just to make the decision. To let Jason's body die now cannot be interpreted as mercy killing or euthanasia, as Jason died June the 16th, 1977. And we have kept his body going artificially for 10 years. Consequently, we should be the ones held responsible for letting his body rest. A tragedy like this changes a person so much. I appreciate every moment of my life now and try to make the most of my time. It seems a shame that we have to suffer so to have our eyes and hearts opened up. If Jason could still understand the meaning of his life, I would have him with me all the time. But as it is, he will never know anything again. Modern technology can bring someone back from the dead, but it cannot heal a brain. It's time Jason and all of us had the right to die. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Lauren. Bill Baker, please.
My name is Bill Baker. I speak to you today as a professional, pro-lifer, and a basic humanitarian. Without these basic qualities, I could not have entered into the medical X-ray technology field 28 years ago and remained for this period. I retired 1 year ago, January 28th of 86, with Lou Gehrig's disease. My age is 52. My disease is terminal. There is no medication that will alter the outcome of my disease. I'm going to skip some parts of my testimony in regards for time. My wife and I have one son, 28 years old. He presently is in a nursing home in Portland, Oregon, as a result of a motorcycle accident without the use of a helmet. On August 5, he is in a vegetative state without the repetitive statements of the task force here today. I am in total agreement with everything they say. I feel this bill, both Senate Bill 20 and 21, offer the solutions for my wife and I to make honest and very frank decisions regarding myself and my son in the coming months and years. His life is maintained, as I say, purely by the sake of a nasogastric feeding tube at this time. In my years as an X-ray technician, I have never had a patient state to me that they wish to live regardless of the means, whether monetary or in terms of pain, that they wish to live and be kept alive. But I have had many, many patients come to me and state, please leave me alone and let me die. As an X-ray technician, we need this bill. We need it badly. I am a volunteer, Oregon, a long-term care ombudsman, a certified ombudsman. I work in nursing homes on a volunteer basis, approximately 4 hours a week. I get much gratification from this, but my time is drawing short, and so is my strength. But I know that there are many, many people who feel as I do. I do not want $1 spent to preserve my life when I am in the dying process. I prefer to remain pain-free, to have no resuscitation. There is no medical cure for me. There is no medical cure for my son. He has received severe brain damage. There is no comeback. He would want this. We have spoke of this with our son in over the years. He was well aware of medicine as he worked for me as a student in his junior and senior years. He was well aware of the risks he took when he went without a helmet on August 5. He was well aware of this from his work with me and knowing of the hazards. But Randy, if he was here, would say, do not keep me living in a vegetative state. He would totally agree with these views. We need this bill so bad. I am in total agreement, and I could sit here and go on and on. But the bill speaks for itself, and I think in the interest of other speakers and the numbers you have here, it is time for me to back away and tell you that it's an honor and the privilege to have been here and presented my views.
Mr. Baker, thank you, and the courage of yourself and your wife is certainly to be admired. Doug Walta, please.
Sorry.
Senator Frye, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Doug Walta. I'm a gastroenterologist. I'm here speaking on behalf of Multnomah County Medical Society, Oregon Health Decisions, Providence Hospital's Medical Morals Committee. Mostly I'm speaking on behalf of my patients. Sophisticated technology has made it possible to sustain life, restore life, and add to the quality of life in immeasurable ways. But conversely, it's created a new dilemma. Death no longer occurs without intervention. It's a technological event, which happens when machines are stopped or not instituted. When to stop these machines has become the controversy, and who decides it magnifies the problem. In 1983, the 1983 Oregon law is inadequate in this regard. It applies only to the terminally ill, yet mandating fluid and nutrition, even against the patient's wishes. The living will applies only to the terminally ill, with the same qualifications. Physicians are forced to prolong the agony of death by prolonging life artificially. This inability to act in accordance with the patient's request needs to be rectified. It poses a moral and ethical dilemma for the doctor. Is his moral obligation to state law or to his patient? Frustration with this bill and the unfortunate patient in the persistent vegetative state precipitated Senate Bill 20. The most critical issue you need to address is the concept of fluid and nutrition. We have the capability of forced artificial fluid and administration in ways that are always tolerable. It may be administered through a tube placed through the nose, past the throat, and into the stomach, with the constant need to swallow. It's uncomfortable. Feeding can be administered by inserting a tube through the abdominal wall into the stomach, or a catheter inserted into the vein in the neck or chest. All these methods have appropriate roles, but in the terminally ill or persistent vegetative state, what occurs over months or years is not curative or caring goals of medicine. Strangely, we're able to stop a respirator, resulting in a rapid death. A patient can refuse dialysis, life-saving antibiotics, or surgery. A patient in Oregon cannot refuse forced fluid and feeding. No one advocates denying fluid and nutrition. It's offered and it's encouraged. It just shouldn't be forced. In terminal or irreversible coma patients, comfort is our objective. And this comfort is incompatible with mandatory artificial fluid and feeding, prolonging that miserable process. Respect for the sacredness and dignity of a patient doesn't require forced fluid or food. It allows an already existing fatal pathology to take its natural course. If patients were in a persistent vegetative state and knew they were being force-fed, what do you think their reaction would be? I think mandating artificial fluid and nutrition is inhumane. What we all have to understand is that there are values greater than life than mere corporal existence. We should all retain the right to decide how we shall live while dying. If a patient requests no fluid or nutrition, it should be respected. Judicial decisions demonstrate a trend that affirms the legal permissibility of foregoing the provision of fluid and hydration in certain patients. In 1985, Karen Quinlan's respirator was withdrawn by the New Jersey Supreme Court. She died 9 years later. Karen Quinlan was in a persistent vegetative state, a condition she would remain in her entire life without hope of recovery. There are 10,000 Karen Quinlans alive in the United States. The record duration for a persistent vegetative state is 37 years, 111 days. Hopefully none of us will break that record. In 1983, the California Court of Appeals permitted stopping fluid and nutrition in Clarence Hebert, who was in a persistent vegetative state. The court felt that IV fluid was similar to medication and IV nourishment no different than a respirator. They stated if treatment were worthless, it should be considered disproportionate. In the same year, the President's Commission for the Study of Ethical Problems in Medicine and Biomedical and Behavioral Research concluded their report advocating the following: not to use the concept of ordinary versus extraordinary means because it was ill-defined and difficult to apply. To advocate the concept of benefit versus burden in healthcare decisions. To evaluate fluid and nutrition under benefit versus burden, as would any other medical intervention. And transfer the emphasis from the technique employed to the actual condition of the patient. In 1985, the New Jersey Supreme Court decided it was permissible to remove a nasogastric tube from 84-year-old Claire Conroy, who couldn't speak, swallow, and was demented. She existed in a semi-fetal position without control of excretory function. She had previously stated she did not want to live in this condition. The American Medical Association's Council of Ethics and Judicial Affairs in the summer of 86 advocated the withdrawal of artificial feeding and hydration from terminally ill and persistent vegetative cases. They felt physicians should never intentionally cause the death of a patient, but in permanently comatose patients, life support measures, including artificially administered nutrition and hydration, may be withdrawn if futile or burdensome. The American Bar Association concurred with that opinion. In 1986, the family of Nancy Jobes, a woman in a persistent vegetative state of 6 years, had the New Jersey Supreme Court approve and enforce the removal of a feeding tube. And in 1986, the husband of Mrs. Corbett of the Florida Appellate Court overturned a ruling, thus permitting the feeding tube to be removed from a 75-year-old woman in a persistent vegetative state. The court found no reason to differentiate between the multitude of artificial devices that are available to prolong the moment of death. Paul Brophy was a 49-year-old firefighter in a persistent vegetative state of 3.5 years, who repetitively commented that he wished and hoped he'd never be in such a condition. As a firefighter saving lives, he discarded a commendation certificate for saving a person's life because that person lingered in a persistent vegetative state. In 1986, the Supreme Court of Massachusetts affirmed his wishes, stating artificial feeding was intrusive and that the law protects the right of a person to make his own decision to accept or reject treatment, whether his decision is wise or unwise. As stated, in certain thankfully rare circumstances, the burden of maintaining the corporal existence degrades the very humanity it was meant to serve. The law recognizes the individual's right to preserve his humanity, even if to preserve his humanity means to allow the natural process of a disease or affliction to bring about death with dignity. And the last and most revealing case is Elizabeth Bouvet. She sought the California court's assistance in allowing her to decide how much she should eat. The appeals court judges ruled the following: we do not believe it is a policy of this state that all and every life must be preserved against the will of the sufferer. It is incongruous, if not monstrous, for medical practitioners to assert their lives to preserve a life that someone else must live, or more accurately, endure for 15 to 20 years. And we cannot conceive it to be the policy of the state to inflict such an ordeal on anyone. This decision absolutized the patient's autonomy to an unprecedented degree. Colorado recently affirmed the California court's attitude with the Hector Rodas case. In fact, every case ultimately has been decided in the patient's favor. What this legislature is facing is the decision of whose rights are sacred. I'm not talking about the rights of physicians, religious groups, hospitals, or philosophies. What I'm talking about is the sanctity of a patient's right. We respect the right of patients to decide whether they're operated on, have chemotherapy, take medication, have artificial respiration, artificial renal function, or be hospitalized. I cannot conceive of a law that mandates the physician administer artificial fluid administration to a patient against his will because he's made the mistake of coming to the hospital. To demand doing this to the patient in his dying phase seems to me incompatible with the right and respect of the individual. I request that you draft a law that permit the patient always to be in charge, either personally, through a directive, family, or through a durable power of attorney. And this has to include fluid and nutrition. We can keep people alive inappropriately under many circumstances. If a person has told us not to, his request should be sacred. 75% of the polled population in the United States concurred with that opinion. There isn't a bill that cannot be potentially changed to later do harm. This does not justify not having the bill. The Senate Bill 20 is before you because many of us believe you have the ability and sensitivity to create a law respecting the right of a patient, yet avoiding euthanasia.
Thank you, Dr. Wall, for being here. Father Novak, and I want to commend the witnesses, all of them so far now, who have abided by our little rule here that we're all going to try to confine our testimony to pertinent points, and within the time limits, hopefully more of you can say something. So appreciate everybody who has testified, and hopefully we'll continue this trend the rest of the evening. All right, sir, go ahead.
Senator Fry, members of the committee, I'm Father Norbert Novak. I'm a Benedictine monk of the Abbey of Mount Angel. For some 6 years, I've been the chaplain of Providence Hospital in Portland and the ethicist there. This present year, I'm serving at the corporate office of the Sisters of Providence in Seattle, serving all of their institutions in Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and California in the area of medical morals and ethics. First of all, I would like to say that the Catholic Church has been and continues to be a leader in analyzing and articulating the ethical principles at stake in deciding whether to prolong life. Church teaching, especially the Declaration on Euthanasia in 1980, identifies the limits to the general duty to preserve life. No one is morally obligated to accept treatment that is useless or too burdensome. Physical life is not an absolute good or a value to be preserved at all costs, nor is death the ultimate evil to be avoided at all costs. The patient's free and informed choice ought to determine whether or not life-sustaining treatment will be used. Treatments that cannot reverse the terminal illness of a dying patient are not morally required. Physicians and other caregivers have both the duty and the privilege of helping the elderly and incurably sick or their families understand just which treatments, drugs, and machines may be wisely and legitimately omitted so that death be not artificially prolonged.